Hi, this is Jim Swilly. Welcome to Metron Live. Metron is a Greek word that means sphere of influence. I believe in living your best life possible, and that's the reason for this podcast. This is my Metron. Now let me help you discover yours. It's 11 o'clock on, well, nearly 11 o'clock, 10:59 on Sunday, August the 8th. No, I'm totally wrong. August the 9th. Yesterday was August the 8th. Sunday morning. And glad to be alive. I see a heart coming up, so somebody must be... Colonel, you're the first one. Good morning. Hey, Jackie. I miss you guys. Mr. Elwood. I love it. I love it when people are ready to go. Ken Marshall's watching downstairs. Hey, Cheryl. Heather, oh, I love this when everybody's ready to go at 11 o'clock. Hey, Ave. Sounds great. Awesome. Yeah, good morning, Elwood. Yeah, last night, you know, last week everybody was up on the roof, and so last night I just said, I just believe nobody's going to be up there today. I'll have the roof to myself, and here it is. You have what you say. Hey, Darlene. Hey, Danny. Hey, Miss Leona. Good morning and hello. I miss you guys. Sending out a big virtual hug to everybody today. I'm blessed this morning. I'm alive. I'm healthy. I'm prosperous. I'm anointed. I'm excited about the future. I'm strong. I'm successful. I'm well. I'm in my right mind. And I'm sending all of that out to you today. I just felt like saying those things. Repeat after me today. I'm alive. I'm well. I'm happy. I'm blessed. Say them. There's the I am statement is so strong. Those words, I am, whatever you follow those words with. Hey, Connie Sue. Hey, Eric. Hey, Dr. A. Good to see everybody. Anyway, just clear your throat and say it out loud this morning. I'm alive. I'm awake. I'm blessed. I'm happy. Even if you feel like you're calling those things, hey, Renita. Hey, Brenda. I hope you had a good birthday yesterday. Even if you feel like you're faking it till you make it or calling those things which are not as though they are, just say it out loud. I'm blessed. I'm happy. It's a good day. I feel good. I'm strong. I'm well. I have everything I need. I am attracting good things to myself. I've sent good things out into the quantum field and good stuff is coming back to me. I'm practicing sowing and reaping. I'm in a cycle of blessing. You have to continue to say those things. So I see more of you are signing on, and I'll look at your comments later. By the way, thanks so much for the great comments. They really are fuel for me. It's not compliments that I need. I like to know that the word is making a difference in your life. It's just very validating and encouraging, and that's why I do the screenshots of them. And it's not an effort for self-aggrandizement. It's positive words. I mean, the more you exalt the positive, the more you attract the positive. The more you lift up the good stuff overwhelms the bad stuff. John said the light shines on the darkness, and the darkness cannot, cannot overtake it. I'll look at all your comments later, but thank you, and keep up the good work. And don't, if you ever feel like you want to say something, and you say, oh, he already knows it. No, he needs to hear it again. So thank you for those of you that continue to support with your words, and thank you for those of you that continue to support with your finances. It's very validating to know that the brook is still flowing, and we're still in abundance, even in, I don't even want to call them crazy times anymore. I'm going to say in challenging times. And I'm going to say that we're all rising to the challenge. I have a word for you today. I'm sure it's a word from the Spirit, but I'm going to go sort of a roundabout way to get you to it. Initially, it's going to sound sexier than I mean for it to sound. Maybe that's a good advertisement. Tune in tomorrow. Bishop talks about sex. But I have a purpose. I think it's I'm a big believer in context, and what I want to share with you, I need to kind of go around the world to get back to this one statement I want to make, which I believe will paint a contextual picture. You know, the Gospels that we have, there were originally 300 of them that were written, but the Council of Nicaea that met in North Africa chose the four that we have as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and I'm good with that. I mean, I've even drawn the parallel between Ezekiel's four-faced beast. Those of you that have my book, The Gospels in the Now, I talk all about that. So I'm okay with the Protestant canon of scriptures, even though I don't believe it's the end-all be-all to truth. I think it's a part of truth. And those of you that follow me already know that. But in the Gospels, there is more attention paid to Jesus speaking one-on-one to a person than there is to him speaking to multitudes. And you can really, even if you don't identify as Christian, you can find there's so much in that interaction between Jesus and an individual. Interestingly enough, the Gospels cover him talking to people outside of the seed of Abraham. The Gospels are all about inclusion. There's more about a centurion or about a Samaritan woman or, most of his interaction with his own people was very contentious. So he was always speaking outside of the box, if you will. And interestingly also is that he never really tried to evangelize people. He just kind of met them where they were. And several of the people, the ones I'm going to mention today, came to him with issues that we would consider, sexually provocative. And, with sex and what's been considered sex sin comes shame, and shame is what creates the idea that we're separated from God. And I've learned from nearly 50 years of counseling with people that the one thing that keeps people from receiving more than anything else is a sense of unworthiness. And so much of what we think the Bible says about sexuality is really what the Puritans said. The Puritans affected our Eurocentric idea of the scriptures a lot more than the Holy Spirit. Let me make my point. Over there in John chapter 4, Jesus meets the Samaritan woman there at the well, who we call the woman at the well. Unfortunately, the Gospels were written by men to men, so you don't hear a lot of names of women. The men are all named just about, but the women, you'll hear the woman with the issue of blood, or the woman at the well, or the woman caught in adultery. Because women, they just weren't considered on an equal par with men. And people who are still bound to a traditional view of the scriptures still promote that kind of misogyny. Those of you that years ago went with me through, I did 5 schools of the Bible. And the fifth one, on the fifth, they were like special schools that I held, and they had video and they had workbooks that came with them. And we could still make them available, but there's a lot to it because things have to be printed. And anyway, those of you that remember it know what I'm talking about. And on that, the last one that I did, the fifth one that I did, I traced the roots in the Bible of racism, homophobia, and misogyny. It was very interesting, very sobering. Put a lot of man hours into it. The part about misogyny, especially going through the Old Testament and seeing how women were treated, at a certain point became so oppressive that I finally just decided not to do an exhaustive research. I just did a sampling of Old Testament scriptures because women were so marginalized, brutalized, treated like property, And that's why fundamentalism is so connected to sexism and misogyny and that sort of thing. And in John chapter 4, it says that Jesus, you know, his disciples go into the town to get something to eat, and he stops at the well. The well in a town at that time would have been like the hub of activity. It was the place where particularly women went in the morning to get their water for the day. They didn't have running water, so whatever basins they had, they would go to the well, and that was sort of where everybody exchanged gossip and where you met. It was like the backyard fence, or really what social media is now. So Jesus stops, and here he's a stranger in this community of Samaria, and a woman stops, and he asks her, which just the very fact that he broached the conversation with her was highly unusual, because he asked her to get him something to drink. And she says to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, even speaks to me, a Samaritan?" And so they start this whole conversation. I'm not going to go into it, but it's the conversation about where he talks about living water and that sort of thing. I've taught on it a lot over the years. It's one of my favorite Bible stories. And what I want to talk about for my purpose today is as they talk, you know, she's intrigued. And she says, "I perceive that you're a prophet." And actually, she says that later in the conversation. But at a certain point, he says to her, she says, "Tell me how I can get this living water." I'm just going with the assumption you know what I'm talking about. If you don't know, pause it and go read John chapter 4 and come back, because I don't have time to go into all of it. But she says, "Give me this living water that I never thirst again." And he says to her, "Go call your husband." And she says, "I don't have a husband." And he says, "Well, you have rightly said I don't have a husband, because you've actually had five husbands, and the man you're living with now is not your husband." And it's very interesting, because the woman's not put off by it. She says, "Wow, I perceive that you're a prophet," because he goes on to say, "God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth." And he says, "The Father is looking for people just like you to worship him." Now, he wasn't saying the Father is looking for people who have had five failed marriages and are now living with somebody. He was saying the Father is looking for people who will put aside the BS and just tell the truth about their life. The Father is looking for truth tellers, basically, is what he was saying. And she's actually energized by it, because he just has no shame in his tone. She actually goes into the community and says to them, "Come meet a man who told me everything I ever did." I remember back in the day, some of you who have Pentecostal roots will remember this, but there were certain evangelists who would operate in the word of knowledge, and sometimes they would come to a town or a tent revival, and they'd call out somebody. They'd say, "You're living in sin," or "You're living in adultery," or "You're this," or "You're that." And oh my God, it was always, anytime you went to one of those meetings, you're always like, "Oh God, if there's anything I've said or done or thought, please forgive me. Don't let this guy call me out in front of the whole meeting." But Jesus wasn't like that. He wasn't in the business of exposing people. He just said, "You've told the truth about yourself." I mean, even in 2020, and look, I'm on my third marriage, so I'm not throwing people who have been married and divorced and remarried under the bus, but I'm saying, even today, there is a certain amount of stigma. If you met somebody that, like, if you, let's say you were single, and somebody fixed you up with somebody, let's say you're a man, and somebody says, I want you to take this coworker out. "Oh yeah, tell me about her." "Well, she's been married and divorced five times, and she's actually living with a guy right now, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. I think you'd really like her." I think even today, most men would probably say, "Hard pass on that. You know, this woman's been, she's had five husbands and she's living with a guy now." I mean, I don't want to use the word skank, but I think it might come up in somebody's mind. Of course, you know, even today there's a double standard for women. You know, men are nearly encouraged to sow wild oats and you know, to make the most out of that part of their life. Women, it's frowned upon. I know some of the men I've counseled with over the years who I personally knew had been highly promiscuous, still wanted to marry a virgin. And I always used to think and would say it to them, I think that's really the height of hypocrisy, because you and I both know if a man can be a virgin, you ain't one. Anyway, the point is, Jesus had this amazing ability to just not even focus on people's sex life. It seemed to be beside the point, and he commended this woman for being candid about it. I mean, she could have just said, yeah, I don't have a husband right now. I've been married and divorced. She didn't have to give him all the details. You've had five husbands and you're shacking up now. But she did, and Jesus said, well, good for you. And he said, that's where you meet God, is in telling the truth about your life. God is a spirit. God tells the truth, and he's looking for people who will worship him with truth-telling. A second example is the woman who was caught in adultery. One day the Pharisees bring this woman to Jesus because they're trying to trap him. And they say, this woman was caught. They specifically say she was caught in the very act, which, if I understand the basic mechanics of adultery, I think it involves at least one other person. I don't know where the guy was. But anyway, they brought her to him, saying, Moses' law says she should be stoned. What do you say? And you know the story about how he wrote on the ground. And then he says, one by one, they left because of whatever it was he was writing. I mean, scholars are all over the map. I'm not even going to go into detail of what I think he was writing, because it's beside the point. The point is, one by one, the men finally crumbled under his truth. Here's the thing. If you are a real truth teller, liars feel very uncomfortable in your presence. People with wrong motives just sort of crumble in the light of your truth telling. I see it all the time. I mean, I'm contacted all the time by closeted ministers who say, I want to talk to you, but I'm afraid, and you know, I'm living a double life. I'm living on the down low. And I told one this week, he didn't say all that, but he said, I'm too nervous to talk to you. And I said, well, whenever you're ready, I said, you might not be in a place to handle what I would say to you. Cause I said, in the last 10 years since I've come out, I've had so many, I think it's safe to say thousands, if not thousands, at least hundreds of messages like this. I've just become very matter-of-fact and very candid about it. You might not be ready for that. Most of religion is based on a false premise. Most of church-going is people putting on a mask. I'm not talking about a mask for COVID. I mean, to hide their identity and pretending like they're something that they're not. I mean, really, the thing that outed me in 2010 more than anything else is, for years I had preached about real people experiencing the real God in the real world. You can't keep saying that without finally just telling the truth. So anyway, he finally says to this woman, because they had all left her, he says to her, woman, where are your accusers? And she looks around and she says, well, I don't have any. And he says, well, I don't condemn you. In other words, the condemnation has never been coming from God. He does say, go and sin no more, because what he was saying is the condemnation, what you think is the condemnation for sex sin, is not coming from God. It's coming from your peers. And he says, don't get yourself into this kind of trouble again, because these religious zealots are going to come after you again. They're not going to come after the man who was involved with you, because religion is such a boys' club, but they're going to come after you. But he says, as far as the condemnation, you know, you've got a woman who's been married five times, living with somebody. He's like, the father's looking for you. He sees a woman who's literally caught in adultery, and he says, I don't even condemn you. Just don't get yourself in trouble with these jerks. And then there's a third witness is the centurion who comes to Jesus. And, you know, he's called centurion. C-E-N-T is where we get the word century. It means he had 100 men under his, that were his responsibility. And he says, but I have this one that's especially close to me. He uses the word, I think it's intimos. It's where we get the word intimacy from. He's basically saying, these 99 of these men are under my military command. One of them is my boo, basically is what he's saying. If you understand the culture then, I don't know that this man would have identified as gay as we think of today, but clearly it was a sexual connotation. And that wasn't out of the norm, even for men who were married to women who were off at battle a lot. Many times they had male concubines and slave boys, that sort of thing, that served their purpose. When you read Romans chapter 1, when Paul talks about men with men, that's what he's talking about. And he's talking about boy prostitutes that were used in temple worship for Diana and Baal and some of these. But the interesting thing is the man says, please come heal this man that I'm intimate with. And Jesus doesn't say it is an abomination for a man to lie with a man. He never quotes Leviticus to him. He just says, yeah, I'll come and heal him. And the man says, no. I'm even uncomfortable with you coming under my roof because of our situation. In other words, we're coloring outside the lines enough as it is. But if you'll just speak the word only, my servant will be healed. And Jesus not only agrees to it, he tells his disciples, this is the greatest faith I found in all of Israel. So you've got a woman who admits multiple marriages, living with somebody. Jesus never shames her. You find a woman who's caught in adultery. Jesus never plays the misogyny card on her. You find a man that's in coded language saying, this is a man that if I'm not in love with him, I'm at least sexual with him. And Jesus says, yeah, I'll heal him. It's the greatest faith in Israel. Jesus never got tripped up by Mosaic law. I mean, when he said, I'm just giving you two commandments, love God, love your neighbor. If you add anything to it, it is antichrist. It is, it does not reveal God. I even think there's symbolism in the cross, that it's a vertical and horizontal beam, just two commandments. Stop obsessing over the original 10 that Moses got on Mount Sinai and then the 613 that he ultimately came up with. Jesus said that the law and the prophets hang on just these two premises. It really is all about love. That's not just giving someone license to live out their sexual looseness fantasies. It's just the truth. So Jesus never, it's nearly like these people who probably wouldn't be accepted in church world today, Jesus, it's like it was a moot point to him. He didn't even acknowledge it. He just said, yeah, your servant is healed, or it's the greatest faith in Israel, or the Father is looking for people like you, which brings me to the person I actually want to talk about. And there's a reason I've said all that. There's another story, and we find this woman mentioned in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. The Synoptic Gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because they were taken from the same original text, and they're not word for word, but their stories corroborate. John was on such a different plane that some of the stories in John were also in the Synoptics, but very few of them. The Gospel of John is just a completely different animal. You find this woman in Matthew, you find her in Luke, and what I want to refer to is what it says about her in Mark. In Matthew, it just says there was a woman who came with an alabaster box, and you know the story, how she broke the box and anointed Jesus. Luke is the more R-rated one of it. Luke is the one that definitely shows, I mean, King James just says a sinful woman. When you look at the context, it's clear what kind of woman she was. I mean, the implication is clearly prostitute. Some of the Elizabethan English may say harlot, but that's what it means. And in Luke's version, which is kind of unusual for Luke, you know, Luke was a physician. His take on things was more clinical, but the story of the woman who washed Jesus' feet with her hair, it's very provocative. We read it in the Amplified Bible, especially. But it says this woman, you know, she kneels down in front of Jesus. She starts crying. She breaks open this box. She pours expensive ointment on his feet, and even washes his feet with her tears. And then I don't know if her hair was up or not, but she lets her hair down, or loosens her hair, and she begins to wash his feet with her hair. Now, if this is clearly a woman who had a rep in the community, because the Pharisee who was the host of the party is offended by it. He says, if this man were really a prophet, he would know what kind of woman she is. So just by, even if the word harlot wasn't used, it's just the implication that everybody in this room knows her. I mean, she's the one that hangs out. Some of her clients, some of her Johns might have been in the room there. And so, you know, the host is trying to take the high road, and he doesn't automatically rebuke Jesus, but Jesus calls him out on it. And that's when he tells the story about the man who is forgiven much, loves much. And he says it about her. He says, her sins, which are many, are forgiven because she loved much. In other words, I know what she does. And Jesus never gave her a lecture about giving up prostitution. He just says, I know what she does. And he goes on in, is it in Mark's version? I think in Mark's version, he not only defends her, but he says, everywhere this gospel is preached, her story will be told. But back in Luke's account of it, he says to the host, he says, I came here and you didn't offer me any water for my feet. You didn't anoint me. And even though, basically, this is a woman who knows how to seduce men. She knows how to come on to men. If there's ever a woman you're going to assume has ulterior motives, it's this woman. And she performs an act that's particularly sensual. I mean, I guarantee you, any married man who says to his wife, honey, this woman wants to come over, you know, she wants to find the Lord. She's a hooker, but she wants to come over and wash my feet with her hair. I don't think there's any wife in the world that would be up for that. They'd be like, no, I don't think so. I mean, you would automatically assume a woman that makes her living as a sex worker, that her motives are always sexual. And here she's, you know, in the Amplified, it says, not only has she kissed my feet, she's continued to kiss my feet. That's very, again, intimate, not necessarily sexual, but it's clearly an act that could be foreplay. It could lead to sexual activity. And Jesus defends her and actually says to the man, you know, she's anointed me for my burial, and she's more in tune with who I am than you are. Now, I said all that to say this. When you go back to Mark's account, Jesus says this phrase about her. And there's a reason I'm bringing up all the sexual stuff, the adultery, the prostitution, the homosexuality, all those things that Jesus seemed to be side issues. In Mark's account, I think it's Mark chapter 14, Jesus says this thing. He says a thing to her, and this phrase has been in my spirit all week. If it's not a rhema word for you, it's definitely a rhema word for me. But usually, those of you that are in covenant with me, if it's a rhema word for me, it usually is. I mean, we're those of you who are really connected to me. You know who you are. Jesus doesn't put her down. He doesn't say, sweetheart, you're making everybody uncomfortable here. You know, pull your hair back and stop this because we're having a party and everybody here is just watching. It's kind of becoming creepy. Because the implication, when you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account of it, it seems like it went on for a very long time. Long enough that it made everybody in the room uncomfortable, especially knowing the kind of woman that she was. But Jesus says this thing to her, and it's so indicative of who Jesus was in his earth walk. I mean, I don't think he's Jesus now. I don't even think he's called Jesus. I mean, in Revelation it says he has a name written that nobody knows but he himself. Jesus said, "It's necessary that I go away so that you..." How's that for a cliffhanger? Sorry. I got to the most important part, said, "Here's the rhema word," and then it goes out. It says that the phone got too hot and I lost my connection. I think it was my subject matter was too hot. I must have been censored. I was too R-rated. Anyway, sorry about that. Maybe I should stop it right there and say, and here's the great rhema word is coming to you next week. Anyway, I'm in the clubhouse up here now. What I was trying to say a minute ago is a cliffhanger. Yeah, for sure. And I don't look good in this light, but it is what it is. Talking about the woman with the who washed Jesus' feet with her hair. In a minute, I'm gonna walk outside and see if it's cool enough because I really like it better outside. I think I have some shade. Nope, can't go out there. All right. Juicy. Yes, kid, it was juicy. Anyway, people are coming in. I'm gonna walk outside and see if it. If I go off again, I'm just gonna say it's. Thank you so much. I'm just gonna say the devil is a lie. Anyway, what I was saying is, I think it's okay in the shade here. Is the woman's, they knew who she was. If you put Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account of her together, you sort of get a composite. And Jesus says this thing, it's in Mark chapter 14, down in verse 8. And these are the words that have just been, I don't know why, this has just been really important to me this week. Not only was the sex work beside the point to him, you know, later in the scriptures it says, "To the pure in heart all things are pure." And Jesus says to the man, he says, "She has done what she could. She has done what she could." In other words, this is what this woman knows. She doesn't know how to, she's not part of your strata of society. She would never be invited to this party anyway. She would never, I mean, a Pharisee, a religious man like you is never going to speak to her, at least not in public. I mean, some of those Pharisees might have known her, you know, as a prostitute, but they would have never admitted publicly that they knew her. And basically, Jesus said, "It's kind of like him saying to Moses about the rod. He says, 'What do you have in your hand?'" And not only was Jesus not a sexual shamer, he understood the motivation that this woman, she's done what she could. She did what she knew how to do. She worked with what she had to work with. Those of you that sat into my ministry for years, you know, just about every Christmas I pull out the story of the little drummer boy, and I always get really emotional at it because it's a great story about just using what you have in your hand, where the little boy says, "Baby Jesus, pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, I am a poor boy too. I have no gift to bring that's fit to give a king, but can I play for you?" And I've talked about how that's such a vulnerable thing to say. Like, this is all I know to do, but can I give you this? And the human part of God's heart always recognizes when people are doing the best they can with what they have to work with. You know, one reason I try to be as gracious to people as I can, I'm walking out in the sun again, I hope it didn't get too hot. Let me go under the shade. Maybe it'll keep it cooler here. But you have to be aware that everybody's kind of doing the best they can with what they have to work with. I know I went around the world talking about those things, but I wanted to contextualize this story because, and this is why I think it's an appropriate word for right now. It's very easy in our world to feel overwhelmed, to feel powerless. There's so many things that are beyond our control. Last night, Ken and I went, one of the guys he works with, his daughter got married. And we were invited to the wedding, which we already felt uncomfortable about going inside, but the church, to their credit, limited the number of people that could go in, and they distanced everybody. But then the reception was out under a tent, and so everybody was able to come to that. So we went to that. And it was beautiful, beautiful bride and groom in a beautiful setting. And I noticed it was out like in a setting with a big barn by a lake with a tent. And it was kind of rainy. It's kind of drizzling. And, you know, my instinct immediately is to speak to the rain because I've had pretty good results with that. But I thought, well, this isn't my thing. You know, I mean, I don't really have any say-so here. It's not like it's one of my events where I feel like if it's my thing, I have some authority to say something. And I'm not trying to take credit for the rain stopping, but I did think, man, it would really stink for them to go to all this. I think they've already rescheduled it once because of COVID, and then to have to cancel it, I would hate that. And then it stopped. It might have been coincidental, because I'm sure everybody was thinking that. I'm not trying to take the credit for that. I'm just saying I'm very aware of really of my metron. The word metron means sphere of influence. I'm very aware of the places I have authority and where I'm kind of limited. Jesus was limited in his own hometown because of the people's perception. Their perception was stronger than his metron. And, you know, years ago when I kind of got known for being good with speaking to weather, and I at a certain point I had to make a disclaimer because so many people were calling me for every barbecue and wedding and outdoor event they had, they'd be calling my bishop, please, you know, please pray. And I always want to say, you don't even support me. Why would I don't think I have any authority with you. Finally, I just got where I said, this is too much pressure. Sometimes it rains. Plan your thing indoors. But I was thinking about it. That's why I started to do a video meditation nearly every day last week. And when I would go online, I would see, good, there's so much vitriol. People can't even, like there was a time you could have a intelligent argument about different political schools of thought. And you know, I've always been a big believer in the two-party system. I think the conservative and progressive side are the warp and woof of the fabric of our democracy. And, you know, I'm glad that there's the tension between the two ideologies. I get that. I mean, that's why a lot of people just assume I'm liberal, but conservative, and I'm probably my sensibilities are liberal, but I understand conservatism. I understand small government, and I know communism didn't work. I mean, I get that. So I consider myself, I guess, a moderate, but not that you ask, but in case you were wondering. But now I'm thinking, you know, over 150,000 people in the United States alone have died of COVID in the last few months. You know, we keep passing more and more milestones of now it's more than those killed in World War II, and you know, just, and now just wearing a mask in public has become a political football, to where some places you put on a mask and somebody says, oh, we're not politically correct here. And I think, wow, that this is oppressive, to think that this has become, I mean, something that's just a medical, scientific thing, that may, you know, it's a new virus, so they're still trying to figure out what actually helps. But my feeling is something is better than nothing, and that's why I posted a thing on Instagram, which feeds into Facebook. I said, look, let me, and for those of you that keep wanting to prove, and I read your stuff online, clearly any influence I had on you at Church of the Now has long worn off. But I said, you know, people wear seatbelts and still die in car accidents. Like, wearing a seatbelt does not guarantee that you're not going to die, but it's going to help your chances. And just because we read that somebody, you know, died in a car wreck, and you asked, well, were they wearing seatbelts? Yeah, they all had on seatbelts. Well, heck, I'm never wearing them again. No, you don't say that. You still buckle up because it probably could save a life. There are people that lock their doors. You know, I look at those, you know, those little chain locks that are on people's doors. I mean, you really think that's going to keep a burglar out? I mean, if somebody wants to kick in your door, they can kick it in. That little chain's not going to help. And yet you still, at night, if you've got chains or locks or whatever, you still lock them. If you hear that there was a burglary or a home invasion, and say, did they have their doors locked? And somebody says, yeah, everything was locked. Oh, well, then I'm never locking my doors again. No, you still lock your doors, even though you know it's not fail-safe. It's not an absolute. I went on to say, you know, if you have a sick, you know, there's someone that has a sick loved one and they request prayer and people pray for them and they die anyway. It happens all the time. You still request prayer when it's one of your loved ones. You don't say, well, I would ask people to pray, but what's the point? Because other people prayed and their loved one died. No, you still do what you can. And I said, you know, I wanted to say, like Paul said, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. I said, believe all your conspiracy theories about everything else. And I read them all the time. People I know, credible pastors that I know, who have posted that Starbucks has put images of Donald Trump on their floor so that all their patrons could walk on the faces. And I see other pastors that I know are saying, well, I'm never drinking Starbucks again. I'm like, y'all, it's, you can't tell this is a joke. This isn't true. You know, that guy that started that rumor about Hillary Clinton killing babies at some pizza place caused a guy to actually go there and open fire. I'm like, where is the sense of discernment that people have with the conspiracy theories? I've seen several people during the holidays post Barack Obama removed the nativity scene from the White House, but now Donald Trump has restored it and he's made it legal to say Merry Christmas again. It was never illegal for you to say Merry Christmas. There was never a nativity scene at the White House, regardless of Obama or Trump. It's just not true. But I said, you know, whatever conspiracy theories float your boat, and I don't have the time or the interest to get into arguing with people. If you don't know better than some of the nonsense that you see, I don't know what to tell you. But I said, on this, please don't believe conspiracy theories about wearing a mask. I'm not saying it's a panacea. I'm not saying it's 100% cure. I'm not saying that science is perfect. I'm saying people are dying. I mean, we're nearly up to 1,000 a day now. I mean, if you think this is a conspiracy theory, this is really an elaborate theory that people are willing to give their lives for. Like, wow, it's like when I hear people want to blame every earthquake and tornado on the gay community. I'm like, wow, we gays have got it going on, man, that we're able to, you know, wreak havoc with the weather like that. And so basically what I said, and this is how I connect the dots with everything I said about the people in the Bible. Jesus said she did what she could. All you can do right now is do what you can. Give what you can. Protect yourself as much as you can. And then the rest of it, you're going to have to let go and not live in fear. it kind of reminds me in a way of the story of the widow's mite. Remember when Jesus told the story about the Pharisees who were watching, because back then, you know, people, when they came into the temple, would make it public what they had given. I know even, I don't remember my dad ever did this, but in a lot of the denomination that I grew up in, they would, in the lobby, it would list the top 10 tithers. And, you know, everybody knew that these are the people that support the church, and, you know, the pastor's kind of their errand boy, you know? And that's why I always, you know, I've tried to keep giving anonymous, because I don't want it to affect how I feel about people. But in that story of the widow, you know, she gave like 2 pennies, and Jesus said she gave more than anybody else. And the disciples said, why? Or maybe the Pharisee said, why? And he said, because she gave everything she had. I remember years ago, I used to teach at Norval Hayes' Bible School up in, I ran a branch of it here in Atlanta for 3 years. I was the dean there for 3 years. But for about 20 years, I drove up to Cleveland, Tennessee, and about once a month, I taught up there for a week. They would give you a topic to teach on a week. And it was great training for me. It's why I can talk about any subject now, because I had so many topics I had to cover. But that was back when you had tape series, you know, and I remember at the end of, it was a Friday night, and I did the Friday night service. You would teach in school, and then they'd have a service on that Friday night. And that's when you'd sell all your tapes and stuff. And, I remember I was back at the tape table, and people were buying them, and I was wheeling and dealing, working deals, you know. And if people bought a bunch of tape series, I would give them a discount on them. And you know, I don't like to brag, but it wasn't unusual for people, just back in the day, for people just wipe out my tape table. I can remember a lot of times going to places, I didn't even have to pack anything up because everything sold out. Now you can buy stuff online, and there's a, you know, inventory and stuff, so it doesn't. Believe me, I've got plenty of inventory in the basement of my parents' house that I would still like to move. But back then, it was kind of immediate, and I was traveling a lot and teaching a lot. And I mean, there's still a trickle. I mean, Avery tells me every few days, you know, Amazon ordered 7 a year in the now, whatever. So little by little, it still sells. But back in the day, when I was very high profile in that world, I mean, I sold a lot. And I remember this little guy was standing in line, kind of looked homeless, disheveled. Norval's ministry used to attract a wide array of people. And he came up to my table, and he said, I don't have any money to buy anything. I'm pretty sure I must have given him something. Because anytime somebody said they just didn't have any money, I would give them something. But he said, can I just ask you this? He said, are you driving back to Atlanta tonight? And I said, yes. He said, on your way home, do you ever stop and get a cup of coffee? I said, yeah, that sounds like something I would do. And he, out of his pocket, he pulls this little crumpled up, dirty dollar bill. And he said, this is all I have. But I want to, he said, your ministry really blessed me. He said, your minister really blessed me, and I just wish I could buy you a cup of coffee. He said, I can't take you out to eat, but will you just take this dollar and buy and let me buy you a cup of coffee sometime tonight on the way home? I mean, Cleveland to Atlanta is like 2.5 hours. And, you know, a part of you wants to say, buddy, you need this dollar more than I do. Just keep it. But I wouldn't diminish his gift like that. I took the dollar and I said, yes, I will. And I made it a point. On the way home, I stopped at a Waffle House or something, and I got a coffee to go, and I made sure I used his dollar because that's what he had specified it for. And I prayed over it and with him, and I commanded a 100-fold return, all the stuff that you normally do. But of all the things people have given me over the years, and thank God, I mean, thank God I still have givers, you know, because I don't really take offerings or any, and you know who you are, and thank you, thank you, thank you. But and especially back in the day, I would always say when I would advertise my books and tapes at the end, I would say, this is back when my kids were small, I would say, by the way, all the proceeds from the sales of tonight's books and tapes goes to the feeding of hungry children. And the audience would always applaud. And then I would say, mine. I have four of them and they're at home and they're always hungry, and people would laugh. And that was, you know, we all have our, we do what we can. She did what she could. We all have our bag of tricks. But I never forgot that guy's little dirty dollar. And I wanted to give him that moment of dignity. Like even now, somebody will, they'll say, they'll give me like a $20 bill. And I say, Bishop, I wish it could be more. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's 20 bucks. Yay, $20. Especially if I know it's like for this person, this is a sizable gift. Then yeah, it becomes even more meaningful. If you can, if you have more, you can do more. But for some people, that's all they have. I never forgot that. That man did what he could. So I'm saying all that to say this. In this time, like I said earlier, I don't want to call it a crazy time. I'm calling it challenging times. Just do what you can. We don't have... there's only so much we can do. I don't have the faith to believe. I mean, I just don't have it. I don't believe I can single-handedly get rid of COVID. I mean, I've seen Kenneth Copeland's YouTube video and the mock-ups of it, of him blowing on it. And I mean, whatever. I'm not making fun of that. I'm just saying I'm very realistic about where my metron is, where my area of influence is. If you call me and tell me you have it, and I have authority in your life, then yes, I believe I can speak a word of healing and you'll be well. To just the whole world, no, I don't. I honestly don't believe I alone have the faith to do that. I don't think any one person does. I think it's a corporate effort. And what makes me feel a little, I have to fight feelings of hopelessness, is that people are so divided about everything, from masks to everything. My feeling is, how do we get anybody to get unified? Even, and when I say this, for God's sake, keep your political comments off my page, because if you think this is a political statement, you have very little discernment. But, you know, the other day when Herman Cain died, I'm no Herman Cain fan at all. But, you know, a few days earlier, he had been at the Tulsa rally, and he had made fun of wearing masks, and then he died of the coronavirus. And I saw people that I know sort of gloating over that, like, good enough for him, whatever. And I think, man, when I heard that, I just thought, oh crap, I hope people realize that's a teachable moment. Even though, like I said, he was definitely not one of my guys, I wasn't glad to hear that he died. If anything, I thought, well, maybe that'll get people's attention who are kind of on the other aisle from me to please take this seriously. And I don't like when people do that. I mean, I've had some of the worst things imaginable have happened to people who came against me. And I'm telling you, as God is my witness, when I'd hear about some terrible thing happening to them, I never gloated over it. I would be like, oh my God. I mean, it was sobering to me. I'd be like, there but for the grace of God go I. So I could say, yeah, please learn from the deal with Herman Cain to wear a mask, but don't revel in it. I mean, a man died, for God's sake. I remember back when when Obama was president, he had said something about the Sandy Hook shooting. And I saw people that I knew were making fun of him tearing up about the shooting of those kids. I thought, wow. I mean, whatever you believe about the Second Amendment, I'm not anti-Second Amendment. And if you believe the Founding Fathers were talking about assault rifles and machine guns and that sort of thing, I'm not going to argue with you about that. But really, it doesn't choke you up a little bit to think of kindergartners or first graders having their head blown off? I mean, that kind of, even if you hated Obama, even if you thought he came directly from Kenya, you can't You can't give him that. You can't say, yeah, this is the one thing we can agree on. It's probably not good. Whatever you believe about the Second Amendment, first and second graders being brutally gunned down and having their skulls exploded in a kindergarten classroom, yeah, that ought to make you a little bit choked up. If that doesn't get to you even now, regardless of your political persuasion, Jesus, I don't think I'd want to be alone with you in a room. That's kind of scary. So what I'm saying is, you know, you can't fix all that. I can't fix all that. Religion and politics have gotten so super connected now. You know, there was a time, I've seen people defending Jerry Falwell Jr. for this Instagram post that he did, and I thought, wow, I don't know who you guys are anymore, because there was a time that would have ended somebody's career, but not now. You know, now religion and politics have created this whole other thing. I can't change that. In my early days, I thought I had grandiose ambitions that I could take down religion in my lifetime, but clearly I haven't been able to. It's bigger now than ever. So all I can do is do what I can do. All I can say to you is, right now, like the woman with the alabaster box, do what you can. She has done what she could. I'm not talking, Jesus was saying, I'm not talking about her lifestyle or her profession. I'm just saying she's doing what she can. This is what she has to work with. She knows how to relate to men in a very intimate way, and she's relating to me in an intimate way, and her sins, which are many, are forgiven because she loved much. Which will bring me to my final point. He said, because she loved much. There's some days I look at the non-stop 24-hour arguing that goes on social media, where it just never stops, and everything. I mean, one reason I didn't do a video this week is everything I've started to do, I'll read somebody that I know, I'll read their post, and I'll think, you know, if I post this, they're going to think I'm meaning that for them. And after a while, it becomes a minefield. You can't even say anything without somebody reading something into it. And if I wear Nikes, it's not a political statement. I just like Nikes. Now, everything has become political. And in somewhere in the mix there, it's easy just to say, where did the love go? Is there any love? And it makes me think of when Paul wrote to the Philippians, he says, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise. It's a big if. Think on these things. Anyway, that's what I'm going to leave you with. Thanks for bearing with me with the lights going out at a crucial time. Just do what you can. Give what you can. Help where you can. Make a difference where you can. If everybody, I mean, I hate to sound like we are the world here, but if, honest to God, if everybody would just do what they can to make the world a little better, the world, guess what, would actually get better. If nothing else, if you can't make it better, then at least don't make it worse. At least, if you can't be a part of the solution, at least don't be a part of the problem. That's why in recent weeks I've been so outspoken about racism. I can't eradicate it, but I can say something that might broaden somebody's horizons and help out a little bit. So do what you can. I speak a blessing over you. Be not weary in well-doing, for we shall reap in due season if we faint not. Stay strong, keep hope alive. I don't know. I don't have any prophetic word for when this is going to be over. I don't know. I don't know what's ever going to open up again. I mean, this morning I was watching the statistics on the news of what's already happening in schools already from the first week, and I thought, this isn't good. I don't like it. And if you think that's just something that the liberals made up, man, I hope, you know what? I hope you're right. I hope it is a hoax, but I don't think it is. So do what you can, protect yourself. Wearing a mask isn't 100%, but it's better than nothing. And then, like I always tell you, having done all to stand, stand. I'll post my link. So if you want to, if this blessed you, if you want to send something back, I will appreciate it and receive it. If you can't, that's fine. Do what you can. If you can't do it, you can't do it. I don't think a tree is going to fall on your house if you don't support my ministry. But I sure appreciate it when you do. I love you. I miss you. Hope to see you soon. All right. Peace.